It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Booyah! Good to have you guys back on Money for Lunch. I am your host, Bert Martinez. And anyway, I'm excited. It's going to be a great show. We have David Court Murray here. We have Mike O'Hearn stopping by. Alexa Clay and Kina Rosen all stopping by to make your day, your business, your life that much better. And what do you say? So should we just get this party started, so to speak? I think we shall. My first guest, David Murray, Wall Street Journal bestselling author and named by Inc. magazine as one of the best business books of the year. Business Week calls Dave's innovation process one that actually seems to work. His second book is called Plan B. David Cord Murray, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you, Bert. Good to be here.
It's good to have you here. So let's talk about this. You began your career as an aerospace engineer, and you worked on the space shuttle. Talk about this.
Yeah, I did. I started my career in 1980. It was a great time to be in defense and aerospace. Space shuttle was just getting going. A few years later, the International Space Station started, and Ronald Reagan was in office, and we were, you know, in the Cold War with the Russians. So, yeah, it was a really good experience.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. That's amazing. I mean, you're literally a rocket scientist.
I know. Well, an ex-rocket scientist.
An ex-rocket scientist. So you're one of those few people who you can actually say this, and we can say this to you. Come on, Dave. It's not rocket science.
I know. I can. Right. And I say it all the time.
I bet you do. That's what I would do all the time.
Even rocket science wasn't rocket science.
It's good to know that. All right. And then you started your own company. Let me back up. You were the head of innovation at the software company Intuit. You started his own online tax preparation company that he later sold to H&R Block a few years ago. And in 2009, Dave published his first book called Borrowing Brilliance, The Six Steps to Business Innovation by Building on the Ideas of Others. And as I mentioned, it's been a Wall Street bestseller, named by Inc. magazine as one of the best business books of the year. And let me tell you, Inc. magazine does not give that out lightly. Business Week called Dave's innovation process one that actually seems to work, which is also a big deal coming from Business Week. So talk about this. Talk about Plan B. That's your latest book called Plan B, How to Hatch a Second Plan That's Always Better Than the First. Let's talk about that. What was the inspiration?
Well, I mean, I spent a lot of time as an entrepreneur as well as Fortune 500 companies. I've been kind of jumping back and forth, as well as I spent in my early days. I actually spent a year in the Pentagon. And so got a lot of different insight on planning. I'm a big a proponent of planning, there's a lot of misconceptions about it. I think Eisenhower said it best when he said, you know, plans themselves are useless, but the planning process itself is indispensable, because it's going through the process that you really start to learn and understand your business model or whatever you're trying to do, whether it's a military objective, a business objective, a technology objective in the case of, working at NASA and in the Pentagon.
No, you know what, and that's true. Isn't there an adage about plans of mice and men or something like that?
There's a lot of adages about planning.
But
one of the premises of the book is, again, one of the things I learned in the Pentagon, they have, which obviously at the Pentagon, they're big on planning, right? They've got stacks, you know, plans that go up to the ceiling. But one of the big adages there is no plan ever survives first contact with the enemy. And that, I think, is a key takeaway right there.
Yes. And you know, the first time I heard this was from a Navy SEAL, retired Navy SEAL. And he said the exact same thing. And I think when you look at all of our plans, they probably have not ever survived first contact.
Right. And that's okay. That's okay. Because if you put the plan together, at least you understand the elements and you know how to make adjustments. You make good adjustments to it, well-informed adjustments to it.
Yes. Absolutely. No, and I think that's, you know, that's the whole thing. Is that you go through this process over and over again, and you're tweaking it. You're getting it better. You're starting to understand things, these little nuances that make a big difference. So let's talk about the basic premise of the book is planning is important, and you should do it. But as you implement the plan, you have to make adjustments of the plan. And that's kind of what you were talking about earlier, where you said plans are useless, but the planning process is indispensable.
Right.
So, you know, so let's talk about this a little bit. When you are going through the adjustment plan or the adjustment period there, what is your advice to people? I mean, you know, should they reformulate as they go? Are they taking notes? Walk us through your thinking here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at the high level, I think it's about in certain business models and certain problems that you're going to solve lend itself more to this, but it's about managing to the metrics, right? Like what metrics do you have, right, in your business? And then you develop theories around those metrics, develop a plan on how to implement, on how to drive those, you know, those theories and drive those metrics, and then watch the metrics. And if the metrics aren't working, you know, you've got to freaking adjust and you've got to do a plan. Like when, you had mentioned in my bio there, we started a software company, we sold it to H&R Block, and this was back in 2007. And my partner and I became like executives and we ran their digital tax division for a few years. But at the same time, they were doing this financial services. They had 10,000 empty stores, right? Because the tax season was like for 4 months. Great. But then they had all these stores with nothing sitting there. So they decided they were going to get into like financial planning. And it looked really good on paper, but when you walked into the offices and you talked to the people that were actually pitching the clients for financial services, nobody was interested in it. The tactics just didn't work. It wasn't working on a tactical level. And so it's paying attention, at the store level, if you will. You know, like a company like Walmart, who's been wildly successful, is very much watching. I mean, they watched each shelf, right? Like what's going on there and electronically seeing what's moving, what's not moving. And you need to think of your business, whatever business you're running, what are my metrics, how do I drive them, and what are the theories behind driving them, right?
Yes. No, I like this. I like this. And look, again, this would be my plan B, if you will, for H&R Block. I think that H&R Block on paper had a sound idea.
We have all
these empty stores. What else can we do there? I mean, you know, maybe we can lease them out or do something with them. And so the bottom line is their financial ideas, again, it was a smart idea. I think the challenge is, and this is the whole point of building a brand. H&R Block stands for taxes. It doesn't stand for financial services.
That was the core problem. Right.
Sure. I mean, people didn't want to hear
financial advice from H&R Block. They just didn't want to hear it.
I want to get tax advice from H&R Block.
right.
But again, I love the idea. Sounds smart. They needed to do something with the name. I don't know, bring a banner and cover up the name for three or four. I mean, so this is a great idea. So I want to talk about this because I want people to really really get this. I want to beat this down in their head. I want you to talk about the difference between strategy and tactics.
Yeah.
The strategy in this case is we're going to use this empty space, and the tactic was we're going to sell financial advice.
The tactic was pitching people while they were doing their tax returns. That was the primary tactic. And it didn't work. That particular tactic doesn't mean there wasn't other tactics that they could have tried. And I think we did try a few, but it didn't work on a tactical level. But you bring up a good point that I think, and it's so often we hear the word strategy and tactic, and it's used differently, right? Like sometimes people will say something is strategic, sometimes they'll say it's tactical, but it's the exact same thing, right? And that always bothered me, that just the semantic aspect of strategy and tactics, right? And so I think a good way, the way that I think about it and the way I talk about it in the book is strategy is what you do and tactics are how you do it. Another way to think about it is strategy is the problem that you're going to solve, that you're trying to solve. Tactics are how you're going to solve it. A really, really good example of this is the beginnings of Facebook, the difference between the Facebook strategy and the MySpace strategy, because they were the strategies were vastly different. Facebook ended up crushing it. They had the better strategy. I think both of them did good on a tactical level, but the tactics were different because the strategies were different. And the strategies in the beginning, and it's, I think it's still pretty much like this. But Facebook, what the problem that MySpace was solving was networking and getting to meet people. That was their stated top line strategy. And so their tactics were like they gave people control of all of these different websites and you could get as many friends as you want. Facebook had a different strategy. Their strategy and what Zuckerberg conceived the social networking as was a communications platform. It was not a networking platform. And so his tactics were a lot different, and they still – and like today – even today – so a good example of the difference in – okay, we've got one company that's trying to make connections and the other one that's trying to be a communications device. On a tactical level, the guys that are – which is MySpace that were making networking, they – on your site, they allowed people to make whatever changes they want. They could put their – they could and design their site, right? They could use different colors. They could put your photos on, you know, the right-hand side and then your messages on the left-hand side, and people could change them, right? Because you had control of that, right? Facebook was adamant that, no, every site needs to be laid out exactly the same. Why? Because it's a communication platform. If everybody's site is different, if your pictures are in one spot and then somebody else's pictures are in another spot and you go to this other spot, it's going to take you a while to learn their site. So that's why Facebook kind of stood in there. And then all of their tactics were all around centered on – I mean, I shouldn't say that. They had tactics that were beyond communication tactics. But communication was always at the top of what they were doing, and still is today. And it was both the strategy and then the execution of those tactics that made them so successful.
No, I think that's a great idea. I think let me rephrase it. That's a great analogy of that. Two companies that look similar, but their tactics were different, and really their strategy was different.
Their strategy was different. MySpace did a really good job. They had the wrong strategy.
Yeah. Well, you know what? And here's the deal. Look, at one point, Yahoo was Google, right? Now Google is Google. Who knows what's going to happen 5 years from today? I mean, MySpace – It's still not as big as it used to be, but at one point MySpace was Facebook. And I think that what you got to look at, it's a combination of things that we could look at it and probably take a whole couple of hours discussing it. But I think it's a great start. And so let's talk about this. All right, so here we are. We're talking about, you know, Facebook versus MySpace. We're talking about strategy versus tactic. So how do we get our strategy and our tactics to align.
Yeah. It's about defining the problem and then coming up with the solutions to that particular problem. You mentioned the space shuttle. The space shuttle was a strategic freaking disaster. I mean, it was a disaster on almost every element. I mean, including disaster, like it blew up twice, right?
Right.
Because the problem was the strategy was not aligned. The tactics were not aligned with the strategy. The strategy was to build a space truck, a reusable space vehicle. The tactics didn't exist to do that. That was not a reusable vehicle, and it's not even smart to reuse those kinds of technologies. I mean, it's very simple. You can imagine when a shuttle gets launched. I mean, just look at a film of it. It's being shook like ridiculously, right? And so by the time it goes up into space and then comes back down, and the forces that's gone under, you have to refurb the thing each time, right? And so it ended up being like way cheaper to just build a new rocket, which is what we're doing now. That's why they abandoned the shuttle program. You know, it was supposed to be $5,000 a pound to orbit. It ended up being over $1 million a pound to orbit because they didn't have the tactics. The tactics weren't consistent. They were building a truck out of rocket ship parts.
Right.
So it's always consider what's the problem, and am I solving it the right way? You know.
You know, and something that you hit upon there, solving it the right way. I think that, you know, another strategy versus tactic type of case study would be Blockbuster Netflix.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
Netflix had requested for Blockbuster and them to align, right? They wanted to do an alliance. They actually, at one point,
yep.
Blockbuster had a chance to buy Netflix out once or twice or something like that.
Yep.
And of course, you know, hindsight being 2020, but
and
my point being
right.
that, what's that?
Hindsight is 2020, right.
Right. The thing I take away from all of this is actually from a movie. It's a Brad Pitt movie with the zombie. It's World War Z. World War Z.
Okay.
I don't
know if you're
familiar with this. Okay.
Okay.
So the whole – and I'm a – my wife thought it was funny that this is like my biggest takeaway from this movie. But to me, it was such a crucial point. So in the movie, the world is being taken over by the zombie virus, except for Israel. Israel – for some unexplained
okay.
reason, started building these massive walls around Jerusalem, and therefore they're like the cleanest, safest city in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so so Brad Pitt character goes over there and he starts talking to the guys in charge, and he says, "What possessed you guys to build these walls? You know, 10 years. You know, you started building these things 10 years before there was even a hint of a problem." And so what happened was they had figured out that there was this email that had surfaced from some medical lab and had gone through, I think, all of the governments. But Israel was the only one that said, hey, this could be a possible problem here. And so Israel came up with this idea of the 10th man. And the 10th man was the guy who's supposed to, or the woman who's supposed to, do the opposite of what everybody else is doing. So if
okay.
everybody agrees that this email is benign, this virus isn't going to cause us a threat, then the 10th man's job is to do the opposite of that
mm-hmm.
and figure out, okay, this could be the worst thing in the world. How would we, you know, what's the strategy here? What's the tactic here? And so because
yeah.
of the 10th man, they were the only city that was surviving.
Right,
and,
right.
And so we all need a 10th man to look at our strategy and our tactics and say, we need a different way to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
That
I
was
mean,
kind of my longest.
but it's a really good point. I mean, the final chapter of my book is about luck. Like mm-hmm. you're not going to, nobody, I mean, not nobody. I mean, it's very hard to predict the future. Look, I mean, people do it, and some of them will get it right, but it's really, really difficult to do. So you have to be aware that things are going to change. And, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of it is freaking luck. I mean, you look at, like, Bill Gates with DOS, right? DOS is what put them on the map. DOS
That's
was
right.
an afterthought. It was an afterthought for Gates. He was negotiating with IBM and had negotiated with IBM, you know, at the beginning when PCs were first coming out, IBM was coming out, IBM contracted the software out. They didn't contract the operating system with Gates. Gates was selling them like the application, not the application layer, the programming language, BASIC
right.
and Fortran and those things, right? And so Gates did his deal. And then what happened is the negotiations broke off with the operating system for some crazy reason, right? And so they called up Gates and they're like, hey, do you have an operating system we could buy from you because this deal fell through? And he's like, sure. And he didn't have one. He just went out the back door, bought it from somebody, installed it, made a great deal saying he kept control of the operating system. IBM at that point didn't freaking care about the operating system. And it ended up that was the thing. That was the beachhead. Pure freaking luck, though, right? I mean,
yes.
He wasn't strategic. He wasn't, like, thinking strategic. It's all going to be about the operating system. He didn't realize that at that time. But he saw an opportunity. He took it. And then he turned that tactic into the strategy for the freaking whole company. So you're right. Your point.
Well, you know
you
what?
Know.
And I think that luck is also a byproduct of being in there. You know, it, people say, hey, you're at the right place at the right time. Well, how do you get there?
Yeah.
Well, you have to be involved. You have to be working. You have
Correct.
To, you know, if Bill Gates had not done whatever he had done to have that relationship with the IBM, then all
right.
the other stuff would not have happened. All right,
yeah,
listen,
it's
we're
not,
out of time.
This isn't pure luck. I think it's
right.
about just reducing your odds is what it's doing, right?
Yes.
You still have to play
listen,
the game when you get there.
Absolutely. And I would love to bring it back and pick your brain some more because this has been an absolute blast. I want to ask you this last final question here.
Okay.
What's the best piece of advice you ever received?
What's the best piece of advice I ever received? Oh, my God. Let's see. I'll say when I started writing my books, I had a mentor who helped me, and what he told me, he's like, and this probably goes for you too as well in what you do with your interviews, it's all about telling stories. Forget about like the content. Tell stories, and then you'll be a successful writer. And that goes for, and we're talking about nonfiction here. And that was really good advice to me. And I mean, I do that in everything I do. And as I can tell, as you do as well, right? It's all about telling the stories for examples. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
David Murray, thank you so much for stopping by, man. I cannot wait to have you back. And
okay, Brick.
This has been a blast. And again, the book is called Plan B, available at Amazon. David Murray, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bert. Bye.
All right. Good stuff there from David Murray. Again, the book is Plan B. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then when we come back, my buddy Mike O'Hearn, Titan for some of you guys who will remember American Gladiators, he's going to be joining us, and can't wait to catch up, find out what he's been doing since last time I talked to him. We'll be right back.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Bro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
It's just so cool. You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. We are back. My next guest, Mike Titan O'Hearn, began competing in bodybuilding, powerlifting, and martial arts at the age of 13. By the age of 15, he had won the Teenage Washington State competitions in all three sports. When not training, he is busy writing, producing, and directing his own projects. Mike is a real-life superhero and a renaissance man in the flesh. Like the bodybuilding greats before him, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lou Ferrigno, Mike holds 4 Mr. Universe titles and was voted 1 out of the 12 greatest physiques of all time by the fitness industry. Mike is a true champion, well-rounded athlete who has graced over 500 fitness covers, second only to Arnold. Actor and community ambassador, Mike O'Hearn. Welcome to Money for Lunch.
Wow, that was a lead-in. I like that.
You bet, man. I'll just I'll have Amy send you a clip of that audio. You could just play it wherever you go.
whenever I'm feeling down or something.
There you go.
I love it.
Well, and
you're
so I want to say
man.
This.
I want
to say this real quick. Okay, so if you guys aren't familiar with Mike O'Hearn, just Google Mike O'Hearn, and you will see what I think is. And I'm not saying this. Because you and I don't know each other that well. We've only met one other time. And that is that you have probably one of the best physiques in the world. You have, I think, a very, what do you call it? What's the word I'm looking
attainable?
For? Aesthetic. I don't know about attainable, but very aesthetic. You have the physique kind of like reminds me somewhat of
Say it without me saying it.
No, I'm trying to remember the guy's name now. Steve Reeves. That it's very symmetrical. you look at your physique and you go, hey, that's a physique I'd like to have. As opposed to, and you know, I mentioned Schwarzenegger a couple times in the intro. I talked to Arnold a couple of years ago, and he had said this, and it caused a little bit of a riot there. But he talked about like today's bodybuilders have lost their symmetry. They have all these bottle bellies, and they're all, you know, and so their waistline is gone, but you have a very symmetrical physique. You have a very slender waistline, and then it tapers up into that famous V shape. And I think that a lot of bodybuilders have gotten away from that. What's your thought?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's not something that's just recently happened. I think that's
right.
Been going for the last 20 years or so. And I think it just finally got to Arnold where he was done. Because he's got such a voice in the industry, well, in the world. And when he spoke about it and just said, you know what, I'm not happy about this. I'm not happy with how they're looking. And I guess that was, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago he did that. It really did hit the industry, and the industry started changing, which is great. I just think it's, and he probably does too, thinks it was way late.
Sure.
For the last 20 years or 25 years, it's changed quite a bit. Like the guy you were talking about, Steve Reese, we're talking about, you know, he was in the, you know, 60s and 70s.
Yes.
It's such a great body. And then Arnold was, you know, 70s and 80s. And again, those physiques were classic. And the majority of society could look at it and go, okay, that's pleasing. And then it just got away from that after, you know, in the late 90s.
Yes.
So.
Well, and what's interesting too is I think what Arnold was voicing there is that he should not have had to have said anything. What the heck were the judges doing? The judges should have been deducting points when your belly is protruding and you can't even do a vacuum or anything like that. It's time to take some points off.
Yeah, it turned into this whole who's the biggest guy on stage and the hardest guy. Yeah, but
right.
The when it comes down to it, and it was like. My favorite physique of all time is probably Flex Wheeler. And he lost the Olympia to Dorian Yates.
He was massive.
He was massive. And both great bodybuilders. But the one thing that I noticed is that because Flex was smaller, he didn't win. But I personally, it's an art show. So, you know, it's don't worry about the guy's personalities and stuff like that. You're talking about two pieces of art, and I thought that Flex Wheeler had this most incredible tapered 28-inch waist at 220 pounds, 230 pounds. And that was beautiful to me, I thought. A very superhero-ish, coming right out of a comic book kind of a body. And I think that was one of those times where the whole industry changed and everybody just got massive.
Yes. And you know what? I've talked to Frank Zane. He's another physique that I really appreciate a lot. Frank
Great
Zane.
One.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know this, but Frank Zane won the Olympia two or three times. His average weight for the Olympia title was 195 pounds, 194 pounds.
Okay, yeah, that's somewhat I heard too.
Yeah, and so you know, so my point being is, you know, we need to remember that it's not all about this mass. Yeah, big is good, but symmetry, I think, needs to be the gauge there, because it, like you said, it's an art form, and we need to, I think, come back to the roots. But anyway,
we're on the same page, and I think we're on the same page. Arnold's on the same page, and the sport for the first time is trying to get back to that. And they
Absolutely.
Came out with a classic. Yeah, they came out with a whole new division called Classic Physique, which is based off of body weight for height. And the great thing about that is they're trying to keep the guys smaller, which is great. It gives the audience and the fans of weightlifting or art shows like bodybuilding something to look at that might even be old school.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, so let's talk about this. I want to catch up. You and I, like I said, we talked, I think it's been a year already, and or coming up on a year. And last time I checked in with you, you were talking about He-Man. You were up for the role on He-Man.
Yep,
I
want
to get an update.
Yep.
Where are we at on that?
No, did not get it. And that's how the industry
how
works, and we just keep pushing forward. We know that. And now the new one is Johnny Cage for Mortal Kombat.
Oh, that would be also a good one. You have somewhat of a resemblance to that too, facial resemblance.
I like that. I like that, and then also I get to use the martial arts on screen, which would be, you know, that's ideal. So anything like that old school kind of 80s kind of badass movie, kicking ass and taking names on screen would be great. So we're pushing for that, I'll keep you up to date on what's going on there. Besides the traveling, that's kind of what I'm doing.
All right, so let's talk about this. So when you're not entering a bodybuilding show or going for a movie, what do you do? Are you on the speaking circuit? Do you do some exhibitions, guest posing? Take us, let's say, the day of with Michael Hearn.
So basically what I'm doing now is basically like what you said, traveling a lot, giving lectures. I have a gym now down in Texas, Dallas, Texas. And I do a lot of just lectures about health and fitness, motivation, and goal setting. And it's been a blast. I've been doing this the last couple of years, and we're traveling everywhere from all the way over to Dubai, to Japan, off to Australia this year, and back to Dubai. But it's just global. So it's a lot of fun. Me and my girl get to travel the world, do what I love to do, which is talk about my passion, which is health and fitness and nutrition and goal setting, and being able to kind of get those people out there and just get them in a different mindset when it comes to health and fitness that can be fun. And it's longevity.
Sure.
That's the one
sure.
thing I think is everybody does it because they, you know, get that little body, but you just live a better life eating healthy and getting your training in.
Absolutely.
So that's what we've been doing. So we've been doing that and enjoying the heck out of it. I love traveling. I'm one of these guys that doesn't mind it. So, yeah, we basically travel every weekend somewhere new.
Now, are you guys based in Dallas?
No, I am in California.
I'm right
here in the Venice. Yeah, I'm in Venice because that's the main thing is continue the push on the acting and the dream. But the gym works out because my partners are down in Dallas.
Gotcha.
And we fly down there, and we'll be flying down there a lot more now because we opened up a 20,000 square foot training facility. And I'll be doing a lot more lectures there and training with people. So that will be fun. That will be fun for me.
Absolutely. All right. So let me ask you this. My train just fell off. My thoughts fell off the train tracks there. But okay. So let's talk about this. You love goal setting. Let's just jump into this because I know that some of my folks are going, man, these guys have been talking about acting and bodybuilding. Well, they, you know, I want to know about how to reach my goal. So When you're talking to somebody about reaching their goal, what advice do you give somebody about reaching their goals?
Motivation is short term, and if you have true passion, that's long term. And the one thing that I realized is I got lucky, and I realize this the older and older I get, that people don't find their true passion until much later in life.
Right.
So my recommendation to anybody and everybody when I talk is find that passion younger. We got the one life, and if you're not living your passion and something that you truly desire, it's just we're wasting what we've been given. And I was lucky enough to know at 9 and 10 years old that I wanted to be like Arnold. And I never veered from that. And I know that's crazy, but if mostly the kids today that are getting into health and fitness or goal setting is if they can find a passion that is more than a title, because that's what I noticed. I noticed that when people do these short-term goals are great. Short-term goals are great, but keep the big picture. And I noticed that when I travel around and I talk to people, one of the things is, and you've been to the Arnold Classic, and so you see people in shape and out of shape in the health and fitness world. And the one thing that I really try to push is this is a daily thing. This is 365. You know,
right. This
isn't, 12 weeks, let me get ready for a show and then drop off it again.
Absolutely. Well, you
really
know what?
I find that passion.
Absolutely. I want to kind of emphasize this a little bit. A lot of people think that, listen, if once I get money, I'll be happy, right? That goal is the money. and that is a, what do you call it? It's a false start or a false promise there. I cannot say this enough, that when Mike is talking about finding your passion, this is it. Because if you find your purpose in life, then you are going to have a much happier life. The money will eventually come, but if you love what you do, then every day you can get up with enthusiasm because you love what to do, as opposed to, man, I have to get up because, man, I have to pay my bills or I have this job I hate. It just wears you out.
Yeah, it does. It truly does. And unless you find something that's truly passionate for you and your heart's in it, it's a tough way to go the other way. And, I mean, you're going to find highs and lows in anything, but if you can try to keep that forefront of your dream and your passion, it keeps you moving through the days. And
yeah.
I never planned to say, the first time I worked out when I was 9 and 10 that I'm going to do this the next 35 years. I didn't say that. I said, today
right.
I'm going to start getting ready. I'm going to get ready for a show, but one day I want to be this like Arnold. And then those days turned into weeks. Weeks turned into years. Years turned into 35 years. And I still freaking love it. And people ask me, how do you keep that motivation going? Well, motivation comes and goes.
Right.
But the passion, that true passion of the life you're living, that picks up speed. I've never been so motivated in my life than I am now. And it continues to flow and it continues to avalanche in a sense that it picks up more and more speed. Like you said, you don't start making money off of what you love, but sooner or later it comes.
Right.
And
right.
It's that struggle. And one of the things that it's easier for us older guys to say to the younger guys, trust me, the struggle is going to make you who you want to be.
Yes.
And the kids are like, I don't want to struggle. I want this to be easy. And I was that way. And I wanted it to be easy. But I look back now and I go, those struggles were probably some of the best points in my life that I could see the road. You go left, you continue to live your dream. You go right, who knows?
Right.
You end up at a job working 80 hours a week, hating everything about it. And I realized when I hit those hard times and I battled through it, it only got better. And the person I became was even better. So
right.
That's just, I know it's easy to say, but it's hard to do.
It is. But you know what? One of the things about the struggles that you walk away with is you get to know who you are. You get to trust yourself. It builds confidence. It's painful,
yeah.
But you know what? What in life worth having isn't a little painful?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy for us because we've lived and we've had these experiences, and I'm trying
right.
to make sure that the kids understand it is not as easy as we say, but trust
yeah,
me, when you will thank us, it's one of those things, I wish I was a kid again, and when somebody says, man, if I knew now what I did at that age, I would be a billionaire, I would be this, that, and the other thing, and it's so true. It really
yeah.
is, because the things that scare us, it's just showing us that's our limits. That's our limit right there. And then whatever that is that scares us, I'm scared of talking in front of a crowd, or I'm scared of doing this, whatever it is. And you go through that process, even though you're scared, you come out a different person, a stronger
yes.
person, a better person. And, man, those are the things that I wish I took as a kid and really sat in it and really noticed it relative to me picking it up later in life going, man, those are some great moments. And like nowadays,
yeah.
I love those times when you get scared and you go, wow, I've never done this. Let me, I don't know if I should try this. And I go, oh yeah, that's my limit right there. And that's just a test going, okay, if I'm scared of this, that means I've never done it before or it's out of my realm. And I love those kind of moments to go, okay, I'm going to go through this.
Absolutely.
So,
hey, Mike, we're out of time. I would love to bring you back and spend some more time with you talking about not only setting goals, but, you know, getting through our fears and crushing our doubts. Mike O'Hearn, you can find out more about Mike O'Hearn at MikeO'Hearn.com. Mike, thank you so much for stopping by today and sharing.
Absolutely, brother. We'll talk soon.
All righty. Good stuff there from Mike O'Hearn. Man, this guy would have been such a great fit for He-Man. He's going to be a fantastic fit for Johnny Cage. Check him out, MikeO'Hearn.com, and see if you don't think that he's got one of the top physiques in the world. You know, he is just an incredible, gifted speaker, motivational, guy, a motivational speaker. You can catch his videos on YouTube. Just type in Mike O'Hearn. And then, anyway, it's just can't wait to have him back. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to spend some time with Alexa Clay right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, Alexa Clay. Alexa is the co-author of the bestseller, The Misfits Economy. Misfit Economy, named the best business book to read in 2015 by the World Economic Forum, Tech Republic, The Telegraph, and Huffington Post. In the book, Alexa interviews Somali pirates, L.A. drug dealers, young hackers, Amish camel milk farmers and New York con artists to unveil their remarkable business acumen. Alexa Clay, welcome to Money for Lunch. Are you there?
Yep, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. All right. So this, I just got to ask you, where in the heck did you interview Somali pirates at?
Well, yeah, that interview took about 3 years, and we didn't actually go on the ground because that would have taken a lot of security. But what we ended up doing was Skyping with some Somali pirates who were just recently imprisoned, and so had a few conversations over the course of some weeks.
Gotcha. All right, so here you are. You're writing this business book, The Misfit Economy, and you're thinking to yourself, you know, I got to interview some con artists, some drug dealers, some pirates. So walk me through this. First of all, I mean, what was the thought behind interviewing these individuals?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole point was you hear so many incredible stories of businesses or startups and entrepreneurs. And I think there's this whole area that's really understudied that we don't give too much spotlight to. And with the research in the book was really to say, actually, there are all these amazing folks with enormous creativity and entrepreneurial mindset who happen to be in the black markets of the world, you know, who happen to be in the informal economies. And so then it just became a matter of really talking, you know, getting into some of these markets, talking to, you know, Amish camel milk farmers and speaking to, you know, gangsters about what it was like to run a gang organization, talking to old moonshiners about how they used to run their businesses and how it was an important cash crop for them. So it really just snowballed from there. And the more people that we met, the more people we were introduced. So it's been 3 years of traveling around the world and speaking more to the fringes of society.
All right. So let's talk about this because this is such a great take on business. Cause you know that some of these people, especially like, you know, a pirate or a drug dealer, you know, that obviously has a certain level of courage that it takes to do that, just like it takes to be a, you know, a business person. So what are some of the most interesting black market or gray market businesses that you found?
Yeah, I mean, exactly to your point, one of my first conversations was with King Tone, who used to run the Latin Kings, which is a huge gang that started out in Chicago. And he was saying, I mean, he's the charisma of any entrepreneur, kind of like, you know, Richard Branson, Steve Jobs. He was really one of these guys who just had so much sway within the criminal underground. And he was really trying to think about how do you lead a gang and really trying to change the culture of a gang. So he was really thinking about new models of leadership within a criminal organization. Some other businesses that I spoke to, you know, moonshine companies. I think a lot of illegal businesses are actually being decriminalized in the U.S. So you have this huge market now for legal forms of marijuana and cannabis. And so that's bringing in a lot of the informal players. There's a great company called Sugarlands out in East Tennessee. And they're working with all these old moonshiners who, you know, used to be part of Appalachia and, you know, outrunning the law. And they're developing, you know, recipes with those guys and now selling this legally and at a national level. So I think it's really exciting to see the ways in which some of these guys that have been really cut off from the formal economy, who haven't been part of the mainstream business, are now being given invitations to join. There's another woman I spoke with called she set up an amazing program called Defy Ventures, which connects people in prison systems and basically puts them through incubator programs where they can start businesses. And think of all the capacity we have in our prisons, you know, people that might have been great at building out, you know, a heroin business and having all the skills in building a brand and going after customers and salesmanship, but maybe weren't so good at risk management, you know, and wound up in prison, but might be able to be reformed and think about becoming entrepreneurs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, if you survive prison, being an entrepreneur is going to be easy for you. And, you know, and if you're not going to go into business, you should go into politics.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you say that because the King who ran the Latin King, he was accused of being a politician, you know, of developing a slick PR campaign for the gang. And so, you know, I think you have guys who are politically savvy, you know, within the underworld, you know how to hustle where the stress of entrepreneurship is nothing compared to the kind of hustle that they had on the streets.
I love it. All right, so let me ask you this. Flat out, what can mainstream entrepreneurs learn from these gangsters, pirates, and hackers that you interviewed?
I think there are a lot of different things. I think more and more, you know, amongst the millennial generation, people are flocking to entrepreneurship where they're not really finding their way within business or in some of these mainstream. And so, you know, the first thing is just that art of hustle. You know, how do you stay determined? How do you really become resourceful? A lot of the guys in the black markets are really frugal problem solvers. You know, this idea that, you know, scarcity is the mother of invention. And so I think there's, you know, a scrappiness really that a lot of maybe mainstream entrepreneurs or people within traditional business have lost this hustler's instinct that used to be so vital and important to business. So I think bringing back some of that passion, some of that frugality is really important. And then I think there's a whole range of things. You know, the way that a lot of hackers, for example, are setting up, you know, their organizations, groups like Anonymous, for example, really decentralized. So they're operating in a world where there aren't hierarchies, where people don't have a boss. And so they have this much more egalitarian work structure, which is just more fun to work in. So I think, you know, mainstream tech companies are experimenting with these kinds of management structures that are super interesting. And then I think just this idea of also copycats. You have so many pirates, you know, intellectual property pirates within these misfit economies who just have a much more open approach to IP and ownership and aren't all about patents. And so I think there's a lot that we can learn from just being more open source, not putting such a premium on originality, and finding ways of being much more collaborative with people. So those are just a few. But yeah, the book goes into a whole number of different tips and tools that mainstream entrepreneurs and business folks can use.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Hey, listen, we're out of time. I'd love to bring you back and talk more about this incredible book that you've written. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I cannot wait to dive into it. The book, again, is called The Misfit Economy. The author, Alexa Clay. It's available on Amazon or wherever good books are sold. This is just such a fascinating idea. I just love it. And it's a, you know, applicable to so many things that we do in our lives. Alexa Clay, thank you so much for stopping by.
Great. Thanks for having me. Take care.
All righty. Good stuff there from Alexa Clay. I just cannot imagine, kind of exhilarating, talking to, pirates and drug dealers and all these type of people to get an entrepreneurial idea, if you will. Entrepreneurial insights, right? It's not the first thing that you go to. Anyway, so we'll have to have her back again and pick her brain a little bit more. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Well, I'm not sure what it is. I guess I'll be okay.
I'm calling the studio, Matthew.
You're not shooting today.
Just get some rest.
He bought it.
Hi, can I get my CRV brought up, please?
Roderick. Roderick.
Life is packed with things you have to do.
But sometimes you gotta live a little.
Matthew, you poor thing. You sound awful.
How could I resist?
Look. I don't know what to tell you. He's sick. Actors get sick sometimes.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Get going in the all-new CR-V from Honda.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we're back. Hey, just some final words. I wanted to just mention this. Listen, something that Michael Hearn talked about, the importance of our struggles, right? It is imperative that we have struggles. It's imperative that we have opposition in all things. It's just the way the game is set up. There is, what do you call it? No shortcuts. It's all, you know, it's all not necessarily what do you call it? It's not that everything's that in life is going to be a struggle, but it's not necessarily going to be easy. Does that make sense? I mean, look, if you love what you do, then it doesn't matter because you love what you do. Mark Cuban said this, and I wholeheartedly agree with this. Find something that you love to do, and maybe you can make a really good living at it. That's it. Maybe you can make a really good living at it. Keep in mind that most overnight success stories take about 15 years. And without opposition, without the journey, without the struggle, all these things would lose their meaning. If you want, I think, something easy and simple without opposition, you know, then you get yourself an easy type job. Working in the fast food industry might be a pretty easy job. Working, someplace like that. Might give you the, might be easy, but not necessarily better. Does that make sense? So opposition in all things is good. The other thing that I want to talk about, there is I think a Mormon prophet said this, that all of these things will give you experience and it'll be for thy good. That's all. Not that it's going to be easy, not that it's going to be fun, but all of these, whatever, will give the experience and will be for thy good. And that's ultimately what we're about, is gaining experience. Because think about it, when you go to hire somebody, who are you going to hire? You're going to hire the person who has the most experience, who can handle the most stress, the person who has their life. Some depth to it. And all of that takes time and all of that takes experience. And most experiences that we learn from tend to be distasteful. That's just it. Anyway, listen, we appreciate you here at Money for Lunch. I certainly do. Because of you, we were syndicated on multiple channels. And we appreciate your ideas, your show suggestions, and want you to remember that you were created to succeed and that no matter what you're going through, it will give you experience and will help you on your journey moving forward. Super glad you're here.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.